This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. The American response to the political crisis in Venezuela has taken a surprising turn this week. The U.S. government is considering negotiating with Cuba, which America has accused of supporting President Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke earlier this week on CBS's Face the Nation. He said the U.S. government is trying to work with Cuba.
We are working very diligently to ensure that Maduro leaves and we get free and fair elections in Venezuela. That will require the 2,300 Cuban security personnel, frankly, the people closest to Maduro who are protecting the in-tight security for Maduro. They've got to leave. We're working on that as well. We're working with the Cubans to try and get an outcome.
Other allies are also considering negotiating with Cuba about Venezuela. The U.S. and several countries have recognized opposition leader Juan Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela. All this as the country faces one of the worst humanitarian crises in Latin America, and it continues to grow, if not by the week, by the day, by the hour for some families. So what do you think about Cuba's involvement in ousting President Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela? What about a negotiation that involves Cuba, the United States, and Venezuela? What would that even look like for American diplomats to bring in their counterparts in Havana in regards to the fate of Venezuela? Join our conversation on the telephone, your voice at 800-743-WLRN. Again, the voice line, 800-743-9576. You could also send us a text at 786-786-7636. Just give us your first name and where you are texting from in South Florida when you send your note to 786-786-7636. Let's talk about the possibility of Havana intervention in the Venezuelan situation. WLRN's America's editor Tim Padgett is along with us. Elena Poleo is a journalist with El Nuevo País, a Caracas newspaper run out of Miami. And with us on the telephone is Nora Gámez Torres, a reporter for El Nuevo Herald. Tim, let me begin with you. You called this move this week surprising and amusing in terms of engaging Cuba as a intermediary here with the United States and Venezuela. Why
well,
so?
Surprising because we were led to believe that the United States and Cuba are essentially playing a game of chicken over Venezuela, and the United States was never going to blink unless they saw Maduro flying out of Venezuela in a jet into exile. Mm-hmm. And the goal being to weaken Latin American leftism. And, you know, on Cuba's side, they were never going to veer unless they could keep Maduro entrenched in power, because they need those tens of thousands of barrels of oil that Venezuela sends to Cuba every day. And they want to keep Latin American leftism propped up. Yeah. So if they were so entrenched in their positions, it's surprising to see suddenly that they're saying, well, maybe we'll have a sit down. Amusing because it makes me wonder if the two sides, if their ideologies, if they're beginning to doubt their ideologies, meaning on the United States side, the Monroe Doctrine, we've got to push ahead and vanquish the lefties in Latin America. And on the Cuban side, we've got to do everything we can to keep, socialism mm-hmm. alive. I was a little surprised and a bit amused.
Nora, how about you? The headline in your piece was, can Cuba be part of the solution to the political crisis in Venezuela? Can it?
Well, it could. It could if, talking to the right actors. I think in terms of negotiations, there are better actors positioned to negotiate and have discussions with Cuba, like Canada and the European Union. I think the problem is, I think both sides are, they both blinked. The U.S. because Guaido couldn't achieve the support of the military, and it kind of looks now that this is a long-term game. And the Cubans are started to worry about their economic situation because, right now they're not receiving, they're still receiving some oil, but the situation is deteriorating fast. So it was surprising, but it's not impossible.
Elena, how about from your perspective, both as a journalist covering Venezuela, from the Miami perspective, but with deep roots in Venezuela. Is this a possibility?
Absolutely. I do see it as a possibility. And the reality is that the Cuban regime still has a huge stronghold on the Maduro regime. Now, we're talking about negotiating with tyrants. So, again, you got to look at it that way, in the sense that you're negotiating with tyrants. So how much can you believe of what they would tell you that they would be okay with negotiating? Now, as Nora pointed out, the reality is that Cuba needs that oil. They're not getting what they need from Venezuela because the situation in Venezuela in the oil industry is so dire that perhaps somebody else taking over, if they can negotiate a certain amount of oil or whatever aid they want coming from Venezuela, remember that wouldn't be an issue with the embargo because it would be coming from Venezuela, mm-hmm. not from the U.S. Right. Therefore, there is some arm to negotiate there. So it could happen, but we always have to keep in mind these guys are tyrants. So this is whatever they tell you, you always have to take with a huge, massive chunk of salt.
Give us a call talking about the international diplomacy that is triangulating between the United States, Cuba, and Venezuela here this week and the latest in the Venezuelan crisis. 800-743-WLRN. Do you have friends or family in Venezuela? What are they telling you about the situation on the ground this week? 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text at 786-786-7636. Text us your first name and where you're texting from in South Florida, or anywhere for that matter, at 786-786-7636. Tim, is it possible? Is it possible that American oil could be on the table for Cuba?
I think so. I think as Nora and Elena have pointed out, I mean, things are getting desperate. I mean, the situation, here's a funny story from this morning. One of the independent media outlets in Cuba, 14 Media, reported that one of their journalists there in Havana was detained yesterday and was brought in, and they were waiting for her interrogator to come, but he couldn't make it because he couldn't find gasoline. That's how bad the energy situation has got. In Cuba. So I think we do have that leverage. I think Cuba would be looking for some sort of substitute for this. But the question is, what would be acceptable to both sides? I don't see Cuba accepting, for example, the immediate expulsion of Maduro. I think as far as they might go would be new elections, for example.
And Elena, the United States would likely demand the immediate removal of Maduro. And the installation of Juan Guaido as the interim president, no?
You know, I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. At this point, I think they may be okay with elections, that with a renewed CNA, which is the elections board, with a renewed elections board, which is a definite point that the opposition has maintained. So I think that if the U.S. can avoid of this going on forever, can avoid sending in troops, and can still come out the winner at the other end. Because remember, the Trump administration has put everything on the line. They have to have some movement. Well, so if it ends up being elections, maybe that's the way to go.
So how would that be greeted with the Venezuelan community here in South Florida, which has been so instrumental in helping shape the administration's response and engagement?
I certainly believe that it will be split. A lot of people are demanding a military intervention immediately, and they were demanding it from the first day on January 23rd. So I think that it would be split. But at the end of the day, the point is to return democracy to Venezuela, and how we get there isn't always what other people want.
Let's go to the phones here, talk to John in Miami. John, you are on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call. One of the main things, I'm a Venezuelan. I was born in Venezuela, and I'm half American. And one of the things that seems to happen constantly with these countries is that we start negotiating from a point that we're thinking that we're negotiating with a legitimate government. The Venezuelan government has been a criminal organization for 20 years. That's what's happened. It's once they take power, it becomes a gangster government. The ideology of leftist or rightism in Latin America is only used as a cloak to take in and take over the government from a criminal organization perspective.
John, got it. Elena, what are your thoughts there? I mean, you talked about, in fact, you know, negotiating with a tyrant.
Absolutely. This is a narco regime. This has nothing to do. The Maduro regime no longer has anything to do with actual socialism ideology. This is all about maintaining their criminal enterprise fueled by narco-terrorism.
And Tim, I mean, the other tyrant in the room here is the third piece of this triangle, potentially, which is the Cuban government.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But again, going back to the point of elections, I think the elections would be the acceptable outcome for both sides because, A, the United States would accept it because they know that if a transparent election were to be held today in Venezuela, Maduro in no way, shape or form would ever win. So that is an out for the United States. And I think it would be an out for the Cubans because it would give them time to sort of prepare working out some sort of energy deal, perhaps, with the United States.
Nora Gámez-Torres with El Nuevo Herald. What's the incentive for Cuba in this potential partnership?
That's a very good question. I think some oil, like keeping some part of the exchange of medical services for oil, is their main concern. But I think they would also like some sort of, you know, Chavistas in the new government. I don't think they would be supporting of Guaido as president. And they're going to try also to buy Maduro as much time as they can. So it's going to be hard negotiation anyway.
Yeah. And what about the political calculation if the Secretary of State, Pompeo, is, you know, even somewhat successful in utilizing some kind of Cuban interface as a negotiator here, about the calculation of utilizing that with the Cuban community here in South Florida and its potential response to that kind of engagement with Havana?
Yeah, it's going to be controversial for sure. I mean, and both sides have put in a position like of, you know, it's very weird for them now to be negotiating, which is why I believe other political actors are going to be the intermediary for that, because you know you cannot go. It's very hard to go from, you know, we're going to impose a dollar embargo, and 3 days later we're going to work, you know, with the Cubans.
Right.
So they have cornered themselves, each side, because, you know, every day the Cuban president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, is tweeting some sort of response against, you know, imperialism and you know, the U.S. invading Venezuela and so on. So it's going to be hard. And also because the diplomatic channels, you know, are very weak right now.
Well, yeah. I mean, how does this even look diplomatically, Elena, from the perspective of Venezuela?
I believe they would have to use countries such as Canada, which right now actually is not in a good position in Cuba, but Canada, Spain, countries in Europe that they could go through. It would be very difficult. I mean, we're talking about, you know, decades of cold relations. So it's not, nobody's saying it's easy.
And the United States doesn't exactly have as lovey-dovey of a relationship with Canada that it once had, given the tariffs on steel and aluminum
exactly.
that the Trump administration put
so
in place.
So there are situations on all fronts that have to be considered, but it shouldn't be discarded, I guess, is really what we need to think about. And I think just the fact that the U.S. administration is mentioning that they could do that is also a message to Maduro. Hey, we're going to negotiate with these guys, that, and we have a lot to offer. So if they take our negotiation, even if it's secretly, even if they do it behind the scenes and in the front, in front of the media, they're still attacking Trump, then, you know, this is also a message to Maduro, I believe.
This is why it was so important for us to have cobbled together a coalition of Latin American countries. These are diplomats in the region who know how to talk, for example, to the Venezuelan military. And let's not forget that that is still the key here. If any negotiation, whether it involves the U.S. and Cuba or not, has got to get through to the Venezuelan military brass so that they will accept abandoning Maduro, essentially. For example, one of the things that we keep hearing is that the Venezuelan military has not abandoned Maduro yet because they're still waiting for assurances that they won't be kicked out of the country mm-hmm. themselves. if they're going to help restore democracy in Venezuela, Padrino, for example, the defense minister, wants to stay in Venezuela.
But Elena, you know, do Venezuelans want those military generals to rebuild a post-Maduro, post-Chavez Venezuela?
I believe they do not. After what they have been through with the military,
it's tough.
Attacking the public, the unarmed public in the streets, they don't trust the military. The military has to be renewed for the public of Venezuela to really trust their military again. And I want to touch to the point of the Latin American countries. For sure, that's something that's very, very important. And that finally, the OAS did, in fact, support Guaido. But there are other countries that did support, but were kind of in the middle. Those countries can also be tapped for any negotiations. We have the Caribbean islands. I mean, there are a few that could be used in this situation.
The OAS, the Organization of American States, talking about Venezuela, Cuba, the United States, diplomacy, and in South Florida, for that matter. You can join the conversation. Voice calls at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576 to talk to us. You could also send us a text at 786-786-7636. Text us your first name, where you are texting from, at 786-786-7636. Nora Gámez-Torres with El Nuevo Herald with us. Nora, let me ask you about this possibility of involving Cuba in negotiating between America and Venezuela. The head of the U.S. section of Cuba's foreign ministry spoke with Bloomberg this week, and he talked about America's, quote, open hostility toward Cuba, an open attempt of regime change. So this is a statement from the head of the U.S. section of Cuba's foreign ministry. At the same time, the United States' top diplomat, the Secretary of State, is at least offering publicly the potential of negotiating with shoulder to shoulder with Cuba regarding the fate of Maduro and Venezuela.
Yeah, I know, but that's just rhetoric. That same diplomat tried actually to meet Assistant Secretary Kimberly Breyer in Washington last week, and he was not received a state. But the mere fact that the Cubans actually didn't shy away from this opportunity to have a conversation on a potential dialogue, to me, that's the most surprising thing. And also sends, you know, following up in what Elena said, sends a message to Maduro, because it kind of looks like the Cubans are starting to believe that Maduro doesn't have a future. And they are the ones that are providing, you know, security to Maduro. So, you know, I would be nervous if I were Maduro right now.
Elena, what is the Cuban presence in Venezuela?
Oh, my gosh. So, like Nora was saying, the immediate and the following circles of security around Maduro are all Cuban officials. He simply does not trust his military anymore. And so this has been going on for quite a while. The doctor exchange program that is in Venezuela sounds wonderful because, you know, it's free doctors for the poor, but they also have to indoctrinate those people that they treat. So that right there, you're talking about the poorest levels in Venezuela, and they're everywhere. It's not only security forces, it's intelligence forces, it's the people that go out in the street to attack the people that are protesting peacefully, and these doctors,
the thugs,
they're imported from Cuba, and these doctors that are in all of the you know, poorest sections of Venezuela.
But there was one little dog whistle sign in Pompeo's statement on Sunday. Look at the figure that he used about Cuban personnel in Venezuela. He said 2,300. That contrasts very sharply with the more than 20,000 that the administration has been insisting on for months as part of their rhetoric on Venezuela. The fact that the Trump administration, is now willing to ratchet that down to 2,300 as the Cubans have been insisting all along shows that the United States is ready to be flexible.
A couple of calls and a text here to get to. Laz in Miami on line 3. Go ahead, Laz. You're on the radio. Laz, you with us? Laz's question here was regarding... go ahead, Laz. Now we can hear you. Sorry about that.
Great. I just want to say that I'm Cuban-American, and if the Cuban-Americans in Miami perceive this particular, you know, lifeline, this movement by the Trump administration is throwing a lifeline to the Cuban regime, Trump is going to risk losing hundreds of thousands of Cuban American votes versus the few thousand Venezuelan votes that there are in Miami, because there's a lot more Cuban Americans who vote than Venezuela and the other Venezuelan Americans. And the other thing is, this would be pitting the Cuban Americans against the Venezuelan Americans, you know? And that's precisely what the Cuban government would love to see happen in Miami, you know? So Trump has to be very careful he doesn't alienate the Cuban Americans as, you know, trying to save the situation in Venezuela by damning the prospects of democracy in Cuba by salvaging that economy, which is on the verge of collapsing.
Laz, some intriguing political science there. Let me put that to our panel. Nora, I'll have you weigh in first. You referred to the President Trump, instituting Title III of the Helms-Burton Act, allowing U.S. individuals to sue corporations that have been using confiscated property, essentially, from the Cuban Revolution. That happened, less than 2 weeks ago? And then here we go a week or so later, the Secretary of State saying publicly that he's willing to work with the Cubans regarding the Venezuelan situation. So does that put at risk the Cuban-American vote in South Florida for the Republicans? And does it pit Cuban-American against Venezuelan-American politically?
That's a very good point. I mean, the Trump administration really has to tread very carefully in not appearing as they are, you know, giving concessions to the Cuban government. That said, the problem is that the Trump administration put themselves in this situation of wanting to resolve the crisis in Venezuela as, you know, something you can manage in a short term. So it's a trade-off.
Yeah.
But of course, it is true that the portion of Cuban-American voters here in South Florida is way bigger than the Venezuelans.
Elena, does this pit Venezuelan-Americans and Cuban-Americans here in South Florida potentially at odds?
You know, historically, the Cuban-American community here in South Florida has been amazing to the Venezuelan American community. I can speak from experience.
Yeah.
They have helped us. They have taken us under their wing. So that would be, I don't see that the Venezuelan and the Cuban American population would be pitted against each other, because the reality is that the Venezuelans don't want to keep giving Cuba oil. So it's not what we want.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps there is going to be a situation there. But if that brings democracy to Venezuela or some other concession, it all depends on how the Trump administration plays it off. It depends on how they do it and how they carry it. But it is definitely a thorny situation.
Another call here in South Miami. Greg, you've been patient. Nice to hear from you. Go ahead, Greg.
Yes. I think it was a step backwards with Trump and the Helms-Burton bill. Cuba had $600 million in gold reserves held by the United States, probably worth $20 billion today, which could be helped to do any deals with Cuba, leaving it little by little. And my main question is, Cuba needs oil, and part of the reason they're supporting Maduro is for the oil. Why doesn't the United States oil companies work with the Cuban government to look and develop the Cuban oil reserves?
Gotcha, Greg. Good question. Tim, I mean, this has been talked about. Nora, it's been talked about. The Straits of Florida, this occasionally will flare up on diplomacy about Cuba saying it's going to try to tap for oil in the Florida Straits.
Well, the U.S. oil companies can't help Cuba develop oil because of the Cuban embargo.
Right.
But I think going back to the earlier question, I think one of the key questions also that we need to ask when we're talking about the dynamic between Cuban Americans and Venezuelan Americans is, which Cuban Americans are we talking about? Are we talking about that smaller slice of Cuban Americans who Trump believes helped put him over the top in Florida in 2016? Mm-hmm. Or are we talking about the larger share of the Cuban American community, which is more moderate and would be more willing to accept this kind of engagement with Cuba if particularly it would help lead to democracy in Venezuela?
Important to remember that any group is not monolithic, certainly
exactly.
When it comes to politics and voting, certainly here in South Florida. Great discussion. I thank all of you for participating here. WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett, here with us. Elena Paleo, journalist with El Nuevo País. And with us on the phone, Nora Gámez-Torres, a reporter for El Nuevo Herald. To all three of you, thanks so much for your time today on the Roundup. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, how much do you pay in rent or on your mortgage? The affordability challenge of living in South Florida. That's next on the Roundup. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson. It is expensive to live in South Florida. People pay a lot for housing while wages are relatively low. That's well known and well researched. The latest research comes from the city of Miami and Miami Homes for All. It finds about 60% of renters are cost burdened. That means they pay more than 30% of income for housing expenses. A separate study out earlier this year found over half of all households in Broward County were cost burdened. The Miami report out this week includes some solutions to reach the goal of creating or preserving 1,200 units of affordable housing by the year 2024. Now, in the meantime, the Florida legislature passed a bill just last week that would restrict the ability of local governments to make affordable housing policy. Annie Lord is the executive director of Miami Homes for All. It's the nonprofit that helped develop this plan with city leaders.
The new legislation, if it's signed into law, could make it more expensive for us to build affordable housing using programs that provide incentives to developers in exchange for affordable homes.
And the goal is 12,000 units of affordable housing by 2024, not 1,200, but 12,000. The bill that the legislature passed is awaiting for Governor DeSantis's signature or his veto. We're talking about the state of housing affordability and affordable housing here in South Florida on the Roundup. What challenges do you face in affording a home? How much do you pay in rent or on a mortgage? This is what we've heard from some of our listeners. Mimi is a single mother who lives with her two teenage daughters in North Miami. She told us she pays $2,000 for a two-bedroom, two-bath condo on an $88,000 a year salary. That's 27% of her gross income. So by definition, she would not be cost burdened. Sarah lives with her husband in Oakland Park. She says the mortgage is $1,100 for a single family home of about 1,100 square feet. She says it's 25% of her salary, 20% of the combined household income. She also writes, however, I bought the home in 2011. The home is now valued almost three times that, more than the purchase price. Can't imagine my mortgage buying now, she wrote. And Brian P. is 28, a government employee with a master's degree. He says he spends 42% of his take-home income on rent, $1,200, and writes us, quote, that's because my landlord gave me a really good deal. So there you go. You want to share your story? Please do on the voice line, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. You can also join via text at 786-786-7636. Let us know your first name, where you're texting from at 786-786-7636. We got a great panel to talk about all this. We'll begin with Annie Lord. We heard from her earlier. She's with the Miami Homes for All. Annie, how does this report clarify what affordable housing is in South Florida?
Sure, Tom. It's really about affordability applies to everybody, right? And increasingly, this problem in all of the county and in South Florida is affecting just about all of us. I mean, when we're talking about 60% of the county paying more than they can afford for their rent or mortgage, that's, you know, something that has major ramifications on our health outcomes and on our economy. So when I think a lot of times people think of affordable housing as applying only to somebody who's earning, you know, the lowest end of the incomes spectrum. And really what we're seeing is that affordability is something that's really hard to achieve for someone, you know, even, you know, professionals with four-year college degrees.
There's two inputs on affordability. There's the cost of the housing and then the income, and that's when you come up with that affordability.
That's right.
Dr. Ned Murray is along with us from Florida International University. You've studied this across the region, Ned. In fact, you wrote in terms of the housing affordability study in Broward County that FIU wrote earlier this year, quote, the housing affordability demands in Broward County and its municipalities have not improved despite impressive post-recession job growth numbers and low unemployment. Is that applicable across South Florida, and why does that dynamic exist?
Well, it does exist across South Florida. We have record employment, low unemployment throughout South Florida, as you mentioned. But when we're looking at median wages of $16.52 an hour here in Miami-Dade and just a little bit higher in Broward and Palm Beach, that obviously gets us back to the immutable denominator to all this, and that's the Florida economy.
Yeah.
The Florida economy is what it is. It's a, essentially a low-wage service sector economy. We've made strides. There's a lot of exciting things going on, particularly here in Miami-Dade, but at $16.51 per hour, essentially anyone who survives on a wage structure is probably in some trouble.
Nadege Green with WLRN. And what's striking about the study in Broward County and Miami, which came out this week, among many things, is just how pervasive the affordability challenge is. It's not just at that median wage level. You get, as Brian P. is a government employee with a master's degree, 42% of his take-home income on rent.
Right. I mean, it's across the board. If you talk to, I'm hesitant to say working professionals because people work and they just can't afford to live here, whether you work at Checkers or Burger King, whether you're a City Parks employee, X-ray tech at, local hospitals, mm-hmm. to teachers. In fact, there's just a ranking this week that looked at teachers who are cost burdened. And of course, the South Florida region is almost number 48 in the country. We're nearly 50, we're the lowest for teachers who can afford a place mm-hmm. to live. And so you're seeing this across the board, and people have to get really creative about their living situation. There's a cottage industry here on just renting rooms, right, where you rent a room in someone's house, but you don't have access to those, shared spaces like a kitchen. Mm. So it becomes more expensive for you to rent a room in someone's house because you're paying $400 to rent a room. You can't use the kitchen or the living room. So now you have to eat out every day. Yeah. And if you're an elder or something like that, the snowball effect of mm-hmm. that, right?
Yeah.
You have parents with children who have to move back in home, because they can't afford to live out on their own. And so you have all of these different pieces, not just the affordability factor, but also what does it mean to live this?
Yeah.
The long-term impacts of that.
Text from Manuel in West Palm Beach, $4,000 monthly income, $1,300 on rent, 32.5% of my take-home income. Folks are ready to do the math on this if they don't have it memorized already. Manuel writes us, don't forget about paying for school and loans for schools. Quote, I don't know how I'm still managing. 800-743-WLRN to join the conversation via the voice line, 800-743-9576. Text us at 786-786-7636. Again, the text line with your first name and where you're texting from, 786-786-7636. Alfredo Duran is also with us, Deputy Director for the City of Miami's Department of Housing and Community Development. Alfredo, this has been a key focus for economic development lots of folks, certainly. What strikes you about this study in Miami, and what can be done?
Well, I think that what Annie suggests and states is true. Affordable housing has always been viewed as the elderly and the poor. And now today, everybody is rent burden or cost burden in some way. I'm surprised that three of your callers are actually doing pretty well, even though they're still struggling and they're still not, quote unquote, burdened. But somebody like Brian, who calls in, who's got a master's degree, mm-hmm. This is the segment of the population that, we're losing. People are going somewhere else where housing is more affordable. And incomes, it's even more challenging in the city of Miami. Historically, the incomes that are used or the tables that are used are countywide, census-based countywide. The city of Miami's median income is actually 75% of that.
Yeah.
So affordability for city residents is even a greater need.
You'd agree the data here, the statistics, pretty well understood in the halls of City Hall. But what about the policies?
Yes.
What about the policies that are either contributing to the continuing gap or the policies perhaps that could be put in place to address it?
Absolutely. And the housing study that we are anticipating getting soon, as well as the Connect Capital study that also touches heavily on policy, are very keyed in on how money is no longer the way to throw into affordable housing. It doesn't work. So we have to create opportunities through our policy.
Hmm.
The city has been very aggressive when it comes to policy, creating within our Miami 21 public benefit program a number of different provisions that allow for affordable housing. And we need to continue to do that to be able to address the 80 to 140 or the workforce level income people. As far as the lower income people, the Miami bond that we're very happy that we received,
right,
together with seeking high levels of leverage from different sources is where we need to be.
Annie, do you agree the city's been aggressive in addressing affordability?
I mean, I think the Miami Forever Bond was a really wonderful catalyst to a lot of great activity. And you hear from the commission, Dias, really wonderful leadership. And I think in the departments as well, planning and zoning and in housing and community development. I think our next step is really about how do we continue the work that's already been initiated in collaboration and inclusivity. How do we continue to bring people together to actually put pen to paper on some of these policy recommendations that have been made? And that there's still a lot of work to do, and the devil's in the details, but I'm very optimistic about what can be accomplished. And I think that we can work through those different interests that, yes, we all, you know, different stakeholders will have.
Yeah, lots of competing interests here, and mm-hmm. the marketplace is a big one, Ned. You know this. I mean, especially, you know, squeezed between two great bodies of water, the Everglades and the Atlantic Ocean. They're not making any more real estate. We're not making islands in the bay any longer. So it's just continuing to rise the value of that. So what about the economic stakes here? And how do you prioritize if you're a policymaker?
Well, I think the city of Miami has a real opportunity here. Of course, this is the first time the city's ever done an affordable housing master plan. They're being done more widespread across the country, particularly out on the West Coast. But the city of Miami's master plan has got to address the issue that we just discussed relative to the economy, because it's the economy that drives so much of the housing demand that we're seeing. It's why Broward County, as we talked about earlier, is also so involved with this process as well. But in order to do that, the master plan has to be a living and dynamic document. It can't be one of those plans that gets adopted and then sits on the shelf. So there are four elements, and I can give you a preview of what that's going to look like without getting into specific policy concepts or funding strategies. The four elements that have to be there is certainly the policies, but also the management of the plan itself. And that's where I think a lot of cities and counties run into some trouble. It's the management, the understanding of who's going to implement the plan.
Some accountability.
Accountability. Sure. What are the performance metrics going forward? We're talking about a 10-year plan, potentially 25,000 units. How does that get done? Who's overseeing it? And that's the management piece.
When you hear Alfredo Duran with the city of Miami and the Department of Housing say that money's not the solution, is money a solution? Is it not the solution? Is money just more funding not work in this case?
Well, the other elements to the plan will be dedicated funding. We do need funding, particularly now, because the days of Washington and Tallahassee providing funding are long gone. There's still hopefully some money through Tallahassee, but dedicated funding, but it's going to be of the funding type that we haven't seen in the past. It's going to require levels of local investment, creative, innovative financing, public-private, partnerships, where we create investment funds that are usable for developers, both private and nonprofit.
I want to talk about some of the policy solutions that are presented in this study. But Nadej, we're getting a lot of text messages. People know this math. I mean, it is, I guess we're in the Facebook age of sharing a lot of personal information. People are freely saying what they're making and what they're spending on housing. And there's some real frankly, tragic consequences of some of this, really just sad consequences. Let me just read one text here from Cindy in Broward. She wrote us a text, $52,000 a year, about $1,300 a month in rent for two rooms for my son and I. But she continues to write in her text, but I stayed in an abusive marriage for 7 years because I know I could not afford to live down here on a single salary. There are even more variables of impact like those.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at, and we have groups here who do a lot of work around domestic violence, but one of the biggest indicators on whether or not women can leave abusive relationships is whether or not they can afford to leave financially.
Yeah.
And in most cases, it's no, because it's not affordable. And chances are, if you're leaving and you have children, you have that added layer. So it's hard on that front. I have seen incidents in our community where there are individuals who need to go to the hospital after a serious event, and they will not go to the hospital because of the potential cost. So it's really looking at the how this affects not just an individual, but the systems around them, and also our well-being. What we're talking about is trauma. We're talking about mental health. We're talking about physical health. Mm-hmm. Like, all of the different pieces of how we exist is tied to housing. Like, housing is one of the major indicators of your health outcome.
Yeah, we've got a call, in fact, talking about housing and health insurance for somebody who's 63. Judy, hold on in Biscayne Park. We'll get to your phone call talking about housing affordability in South Florida again here on the South Florida Roundup and talking about potential solutions. That's all to come as the Roundup continues after this. We're back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening. Continuing our conversation about affordable housing in South Florida, what are your experiences with it? The City of Miami released a new report this week looking at solutions to reach a goal of creating or preserving 12,000 affordable housing units in the city by 2024. Nikki in Davie wrote us a note saying that she pays $2,300 a month in rent for a 3-bed, 2-bath home. In June, she's moving to a 2-2 for $1,700 in Dania Beach. She says she's a musician and wants to lower her debt-to-income ratio, living with her sister who's on disability and a fixed income. Ryan wrote us a note. He's just bought a 3-bedroom, 2-bath home in South Miami. Congratulations, Ryan. For more than $500,000, he says he pays 10% of his gross family income on mortgage alone. He says a big issue that needs to be discussed is the high cost of insurance and taxes. He pays $5,000 in insurance, $10,000 in property taxes per year. If he's paying 10% of his gross monthly salary on a home that's $500,000, I think a lot of folks, Ned Murray at FIU, would look at Ryan and say, congratulations, Ryan, you're doing pretty good there. But insurance is certainly another kind of embedded cost of home ownership, but also for renting, because it winds up just getting passed along from the landlord, of course, to the renter. All right, we've got a panel of folks here to talk about this. Annie Lord is with Miami Homes for All. It was one of the groups behind the study that came out this week. Six solutions that were offered up here, including increasing the number of affordable rental units. How do you go about doing that in a market environment which has put a premium on land and means that the developers need to extract as much value as possible out of that land if they're building for residential use?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And, you know, one of the earlier points was, you know, how much can money really contribute to solving this problem? And the good news is that thanks to research by University of Miami recently, we know a lot more about the vacant and publicly owned land in Miami-Dade. And, you know, there's quite a bit of it. And so we think that that land is potentially a major source of solutions for our affordability. And we still are conducting analysis on that land, but we think that that land is probably really conducive to, smaller apartments, which, you know, for either rent or to be owned, that are really organic to most of the neighborhoods we're all familiar with.
Alfredo Duran with the City of Miami. Is land, undeveloped land, part of that solution to create brand new affordable housing? Is that land available in the City of Miami?
Absolutely. I mean, land, you don't have the land, you can't build.
That's right.
So, and not only is we're actually looking at the information that the University of Miami put together as far as those available sites. And our planning department is looking at those sites that are co-owned or owned by the county and the city and see how we, and they are buildable, and they have active zoning, how we can assemble and work together in partnership so that the city and the county can work together. We work in partnerships in many of the developments that we are involved in. Form a partnership, hopefully we can, that we can utilize our private land.
Do you envision the government entities retaining ownership of that land and partnering then with a private developer to put something on top of it?
Well, absolutely. That's the way to go. I mean, it's publicly owned right now.
Right.
Yeah.
But so you're not going to sell that to a developer with strings attached for housing affordability.
If we could, it could be sold, it could be kept, and we can, on a long-term lease. There's many different ways of distributing that land, but definitely we have to first identify it so that we can build on it.
Some of those solutions also, Annie, here include addressing zoning to allow for different types of housing, and also reducing property taxes. When you're talking about reducing property taxes, you're talking about reducing the revenue to government entities. Certainly the city of Miami, if you're in the city, but also the school district and fire districts and other kinds of districts, all that to kind of get paid because of that property tax.
Sure. And that's definitely a major consideration.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things where we actually have to do the hard work of sorting out based on our priorities. And there's more priorities in addition to affordable housing, right? So how do we balance those priorities and work together to understand what's possible without detracting too much from the other services and resources that we need? And this is a really common tool that's done across the country. It's even done across Florida.
Mm-hmm.
There were new rules that allowed for this in Jacksonville recently, and we have some of this here already in Miami-Dade. So it's really about understanding, okay, how much are we willing to pay
right.
to have that as a possibility?
Alfredo, you're shaking your head yes.
Yes,
that.
And absolutely. You know, some things, we have to go through the legalities of it and how we can actually implement these things. Anything dealing with taxes, actually the state is involved in has a say in that.
Increasingly so.
Exactly. So you have linkage fees, you have vacancy fees, inclusionary zoning, all of these policy suggestions that were given on Monday.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm sure will be in our...
Vacancy fees are interesting. Let's talk a little bit about those, because certainly there is a seasonal population here in South Florida. Vacancy
right.
fees would be what? If a condominium is vacant for 179 days a year, they pay
absolutely,
extra
and it sounds like a no-brainer, right? You're gone 6 months, we should collect a fee on you. But there's also legalities involved with that. You know, what type of services are we giving to justify that type of vacancy fee?
Yeah.
So, you know, we got to get through that, but definitely nothing is off the table. Everything has to be considered.
Robert and Kendall on line two, you've been patient. Go ahead, Robert, you're on the radio.
Hey, guys, thank you very much for taking my call. And, I'm currently a medical fellow in training at Jackson Memorial, and basically, I have to compromise in order to be able to afford living in Miami. I basically, what I had to do is I have to commute upwards of 3 hours, you know, every day in order to be able to afford living in the city. And that just, you know, goes up and, you know, takes into account not only the amount of time that I have to spend every day, but, you know, increases traffic and then, you know, the cost of gas as well as the cost of tolls. So all in all, it's just really difficult. And, you know, what ends up happening is that eventually, you know, once I'm done with my training, most likely I'm going to move out of South Florida, because I don't think that this is something that is, you know, affordable in the future.
You're getting, you got collective groans at the 3 hour commute, and you're getting collective head nodding about having to move out of Miami.
You know,
we talk about
affordable housing and how the economics of a household but transportation is the alleviator of affordable housing needs. If we had a decent transportation system that takes us from the north to the east and the west to the east, we would be a lot better off. Transportation is definitely an issue. If he had better transportation, he wouldn't feel so bad.
Transportation helps, but I don't think it alleviates the need of affordable housing here, only because if it's unaffordable for you, it doesn't matter that you can get to where you need to go, because we're seeing pressures everywhere. It used to be that you would go to Homestead or South Dade for affordability issues, but that's no longer the case.
Right.
Or people would go to Southern
Broward.
Right, and then you'll be like, oh, I'm going to move to Broward, but that's no longer the case. So
yeah.
All around us at some point, moving further away will not necessarily solve the issue with affordability, though absolutely transportation helps in the conversation. But I think we have to be very real that these pressures are everywhere, regardless of where in this metro region you live, whether you're in Palm Beach County to Monroe County, that these pressures are happening all around us.
Annie?
Yeah, you know, and your point is that these pressures are all around us and almost entirely prevalent. And so I think one of the big, that puts even more pressure on us to preserve the affordable housing that we have in addition to building new. And that's a major part of our strategy.
Can you address, Alfredo, this affordable housing label? We got a text message here from 786 who writes, much of what falls under the affordable housing classification is either in or just on the border of what many would consider an undesirable area.
Hmm. Again, affordability is based on what your income is and what your payment for your housing is. If he's referring to affordable projects or developments that have been exclusively, yes, they go where the cheapest land is available.
Mm-hmm.
But affordability can be built anywhere. It's all about the subsidy and the financing you have.
I think what the person is probably referencing is the cheapest housing available, right? Like, where are the places you can find housing for under $1,000 a month? And typically, those are predominantly Black neighborhoods, like Liberty City,
mm-hmm.
Overtown,
mm-hmm.
used to be Little Haiti, not so much anymore. But what we're also finding is in those neighborhoods where you have the cheapest housing is also slum housing, that this is housing in horrible condition, that it's mold, your landlord isn't fixing anything, you may not have... I've gone out where people don't have working toilets and the kids use a bathroom outside.
Yeah.
So the cheapest housing is also slum housing. And so that needs to be part of the conversation. We talk about keeping affordable housing. What is affordable also has to be livable with dignity for people.
And then, Mary, I'll give you the last 20 seconds.
Yes. We used to have a motto through HUD, actually, safe, decent, and affordable housing. Miami is really up against that right now, because a lot of the housing that we have that might be affordable is no longer safe and it's no longer decent, and God forbid a hurricane comes up the I-95 corridor.
We have to leave the climate gentrification vulnerability for another conversation, but lots to talk about. I appreciate all of you. Ned Murray with FIU, Annie Lord with Miami Homes from All, Alfredo Duran with the City of Miami. Thanks to you. Nadej Green, always great to have you on the program as well from WLRN. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. News director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. Director of Radio Operations, Peter Meritz. And director of Radio Programming is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting WLRN.